invest in yourself wisely, you pay yourself the best return.
Hey everyone, it's Mike Spagunski here. I am very excited to talk to Rob Moore today, who is a serial entrepreneur, a best-selling author of multiple books, and I've only got one book in my inventory, but Rob has more than 10, so I'm extremely excited to talk to him. Rob's spoken to some of the most famous people on the internet and around the world, including Jordan Peterson and a large variety of other entrepreneurs, internet celebrities, so I'm really excited to catch up with you, Rob. So if you don't mind, just give us a little bit of an introduction. Maybe I only touched on the surface there, but tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, Mike, I've been an entrepreneur for 17 years now, so I feel like a granddad. And in 2005, my dad had a nervous breakdown in his pub in front of all of his customers, and I was working behind the bar for him while I was a bit lost in my life. And I'd got around £50,000 in personal debt, car loans and credit cards and credit cards and credit cards. And my dad had raised me to be an entrepreneur. I worked in his pubs and bars from about age six, and I liked doing that more than going to school. But the school system, you know, the education system, which I think is a bit outdated, Mike, sort of took me down a road that I just didn't fit. I was, as we say in England, I was a square peg in a round hole.
Right.
And so I feel like I got lost from sort of age 18 to 26, 27, where I got into debt. You know, what happened with my dad really shook me, and I just felt really lost. And when I was watching the police beat my dad up on the front lawn of his pub in front of all of his customers and tying him up and putting him in this reinforced police van, it was like the world stopped. And I felt this deep sense of shame, but also this deep sense of I have to do something with my life. My life probably can't get any worse than this without a major death. And so to keep the next 17 years really short, Mike, and just read it like a CV, I went to a property networking event. I met my business partner there, first try. We now own 360 property units together, and we have 1,300 tenants. We have the biggest UK property training company. We're over 150 million in sales now. I've written 18 books, many on real estate and on entrepreneurial ventures like money and time management and routine and things like that. I have one of the biggest podcasts in the world called Disruptors. We're 7 years in, nearly 1,000 episodes now. I broke the world record twice for the longest public speech. I have maybe 1.5 million followers on social media. And there's probably some stuff I've missed along the way. I have nearly 150 staff in my offices here. I'm just sat in my studio. And so that's the radio edit, not the full extended remix.
Well, I'll have to dig into some of your books, and maybe you've got a piece of content you can share with us later. If, you know, just to learn about your whole story, is there anything like that out there? Like one piece of content where you just go through all of that origin story to where you're at now? Do you have anything like that?
Yeah, probably my book, Money. That's the UK's best-selling book on money since it launched. And that did really well here in the UK. And yeah, it's got my journey in there, but it's really an encyclopedia on money and how money works. Because I think in England, Mike, we have quite a negative association with money and success. And I wanted to bust a lot of those myths.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of cultural myths around money and just how to make it, how to spend it, how to save it and compound it. And speaking of money, so you talked about real estate, and that was kind of your first business venture. So I'm curious, how did you make your first $1,000 in an online capacity? Not through real estate, through offline, but through online.
Well, I remember this really vividly, Mike, because my business partner and I, over a two-year period, had bought about 50 properties, only small single-family homes, but I could hardly grow a beard back then. You know, we were doing well, we were young, and people have been saying to us, oh, you should teach other people how to do it, or how can I buy 50 properties in 2 years? And Rob, how did you manage to get a business partner and get him to fund all the deals and it be none of your own money? And we started getting these questions everywhere. And I said to my business partner, we should do a course on this. Let's do a what we call in the UK a buy-to-let course, you know, or a property investment course. And we built up some contacts and a little database from some Google ads. And I'm talking over 15 years ago, Mike. Anyway, I just said, right, let's do a networking event. Let's give everyone a free ticket. I'd seen a couple of the big Americans do like this seminar funnel model. And I thought, I wonder if we might be able to do something like that. So anyway, to my immense surprise, we got 70 to 80 people filled in this very small London hotel, all to come to listen to us talk about our story of property investing. And without even telling my business partner, at the end of that event, I sold a 2-day property investing masterclass for £2,000, and we sold about 25 of them. So I did a £50,000 sale. Wow. First time I'd made any money other than actually owning real estate. And my business partner at the end said, what is this course then? And I said, well, we haven't written it yet, but let's spend the next couple of weeks writing it. And so I sat him down and we wrote this buy-to-let course. So I didn't make my first 1,000. I made my first 50,000 in one go.
Wow. I mean, that's very impressive. I think a lot of people could learn from that trajectory where you were essentially testing an offer and it really resonated with that market. And then you built it afterwards. And, you know, I've done that with a lot of my offers as well. I test ideas. I see if there's any sort of need for that. And the true way to test something, if it's going to work, is, again, like you said, they took out their wallet, they bought it before they even had anything in their hands, and you just kind of build it as you go. And I think that's one of the best ways to build a program, to build a course, or to do any type of service. Don't waste 2 to 3 years building it. Test it and make sure that's a viable product market fit before you go ahead and get started with it. So I guess that's a big focus. You had a slam dunk on the first business success. So what was your first big business failure in the online space?
My biggest business failure in the online space was not getting into it when Steve Jobs started Apple in his garage and investing in the shares. Mike, I get asked this quite a lot, and I want this to sound as humble as possible and without avoiding the question, because I ask that on my podcast every week, what's your biggest failure? And some people say, oh, well, I don't see failure as failure. It's a lesson. And whilst I agree with them, I actually want them to tell me something they actually failed in. But I have not lost any money. I haven't. We have not made a duff investment. I've never gone bust. I would not want to go bust, Mike. I know there's a culture in America where if you've gone bust once or twice, you know, you're a trier, you're an entrepreneur, you're investable. But I would do everything I could to ensure I didn't go bust. So I've not had a failure in the online space. I mean, look, I've done launches that haven't sold as many as I would have liked.
Right.
I've got the pricing wrong, or we haven't filled an event. But you just make up for it by doing it again. So, no, my biggest failure was only not doing it earlier when I had the chance.
Yeah, I think that is definitely like a lot of my entrepreneurial friends. We don't really internalize it as a failure. It's the learning experience. And a lot of times, you know, like, looking back at failures, you know, if it wasn't a 1,000x, you might internalize that as a failure, depending on what your goals were. And like you mentioned, like some of those things, they might not as big as been as big of a success as you initially thought. And in that time, it might be a learning experience. So, Rob, you do so much. You're doing a lot of content. You're involved in a lot of businesses. Can you walk us through a little bit of a split of your monetary income? How is that broken down? As somebody who also has a lot of income sources, people are always curious to know, you know, is it 10% from your books or 15% from YouTube? What does that split look like? Just kind of an estimate.
Yeah, I can. Though this might not be to the nth degree accurate.
Right.
So I'll give you some estimation.
Just ballpark.
So I have various training businesses, online and live seminars. We run up to 800 live seminar days a year in the UK. And in terms of gross income, that would be the highest. That might be about 60%. In terms of net income, it's probably more like 40%. And then we have our real estate portfolio, which, like I said, is 1,300 tenants that my company manages, of which 360 of those property units I own with my partner. And so gross income, that might be 25%. Net income, that might be 20%, because that's quite a high margin, that one, for us. We haven't got really big mortgages. Whereas, you know, our training business did 19 million in sales last year, but under a 20% profit margin. So actually the real estate income is a higher margin, and we're paying down the loans and we're getting the capital growth. And so then let's say there's, let's just say for argument's sake, 30% left, gross or net. And that's divided between books, my podcast Disruptors, my YouTube channel, my Rob.team membership site. I have nearly 10,000 paying members to that. And that, and then I have my personal assets. So I invest in various stocks and other assets for myself. So that's roughly the split. We have a property management company that maybe makes about 10% of our income gross.
Wow, that's fascinating. It sounds like you're fairly heavily involved in real estate, right? If you had to go back and start over again, would you kind of follow the same path? Would you recommend people to kind of go down the real estate investment path? Or would you recommend just start something online?
Whenever anyone asks me a question, Mike, would you rather do A or B? My brain can't help but say, well, why can't I do A and B?
Yeah.
I'm just a bit of a, my podcast is called Disruptors. So going back, assuming the world hadn't dramatically changed, I'd probably do the same thing again, Mike. I've done over 150 million in revenue. You know, I'm a kid that came from nothing, was 50 grand in debt. So like, that's pretty good. Like, you know, I could have failed. So there's one thing I probably would say, like, my business partner believes maybe we are a bit bloated in real estate. You know, he would like to see us have slightly less of the percentage of our assets in real estate, which means he wants us to maybe buy some other businesses or start some other businesses or build some other assets or build up some of our other assets. Because, you know, we've got tens of millions of debt and, you know, our portfolio is across the board, not a million miles off 100 million now. And he's a bit worried about the exposure of having hundreds of units in one city. Right. So going back, I'd definitely get into real estate like I did. As soon as I could figure it out and felt like I knew it, I'd definitely get into training it as soon as I could, because it's a great foil. You know, become great at something and become a millionaire in that venture, and then make millions teaching other people that expertise. That's a great business model. A bit like someone who becomes a black belt in martial arts. My friend, who was Michael Jackson's bodyguard, he became a black belt in martial arts. He bodyguarded Michael Jackson. He became great at that. And then he built the biggest martial arts franchise in the world, teaching others how to do it. That, I mean, that is just such an obvious thing that people don't do.
Right.
So, but you've got to do it that way round. I think in modern day, Mike, there are a few people that are not really done it and then trying to teach it before they've done it.
Right.
But I probably wouldn't do anything differently. What I would do now, though, Mike, is I would definitely leverage digital assets more.
Yeah.
So building a membership site and, you know, maybe I own some NFTs, I own some cryptos, owning digital real estate and web domains and things like that, maybe even metaverse. Obviously, that wasn't around when I started, because I think it's a good foil to have some physical and some digital.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned buying, because that's my background. I helped build the fastest growing company in the United States, a company that helps people buy and sell cash flowing online businesses. And these micro assets can be cash flowing from day one. You can plug it into the Rob Moore Disrupt universe, and just with your audience alone, find a business that's kind of a similar fit and scale the heck out of these businesses, because they already have the product market fit. They've been working for 5 to 10 years. and then you just throw fuel on the fire and can kind of blow these businesses up. So I think that's a great fit for somebody like yourself who's looking to kind of already has that huge exposure in the real estate realm to find a, start acquiring businesses, because it's just such a faster path. It's much easier to go from, you know, $10,000 a month to $100,000 than it is to go from zero to 10,000, right? That usually is the hard part. So yeah, if you're ever interested in that, let me know. I practice what I preach to and have my own portfolio of software businesses, anything that's cash flowing and has a little bit of a moat around it. So I think, you know, we can have a separate conversation hopefully about that someday. But as far as like, you know, the disrupt stuff, Rob, what is your kind of plan to continue disrupting the world? What do you have planned in the future here?
Well, I have a foundation called the Rob Moore Foundation to help young and underprivileged people across the world start meaningful enterprises that change the world. And I put all my profits from my book money into that. I raised well over £100,000 from my public speaking world records. It went to that. I'll probably raise £130,000 in a charity boxing match I'm doing that will go to that. So certainly for me to be continually disruptive would be to help disruptive startups. So look, I'm not Elon Musk. You know, we can't all be the most disruptive, you know, Uber, Airbnb, Tesla. You know, these are the most disruptive companies in the world. But you can be a level down where you're a bit of a nuisance to the mainstream. And that's probably more like me. I like being a nuisance to my competitors. I like being a nuisance to outdated, bored, bloated business models. I'm certainly a nuisance in my content to the government and the central banks, because I think it's all outdated and bloated. But I see my disruption now in maybe funding 10,000 mini disruptors who can all be around the world disrupting in various spaces through my foundation and my education, which is my big focus now is my education. I do content every day. I have millions of followers. I get tens of millions of views on my content probably a week now. And then through the foundation, if I can fuel and fund up a load of these mini disruptors in underprivileged parts of the UK and the world, because so many people out there, they just need a bit of support. They've got a great idea. They've got hustle. They just need a bit of mentorship and a bit of money. And that's how I think I can be the most disruptive.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got some great stuff in the works and you've already established yourself so much. I'm curious, you know, what it is like if you had a one sentence of an impact, Rob Moore did X, Y, and Z, you know, what do you want to be remembered for?
Well, I have a quote which I have probably said 100,000 times, and it's mine. It's not nicked off of, you know, Brian Tracy or something. And it is, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything. And I would like to be remembered for helping people out of their comfort zone to take slightly bigger risks, to do meaningful things, instead of staying comfortable and then later in life regretting not taking the risks. So as much as it might be nice to be remembered for being a zillionaire or, you know, having a statue built after you, I'm more interested in being remembered for helping people increase their risk threshold and doing uncomfortable, exciting, and meaningful things with their life. If you don't risk anything, you risk everything.
Yeah, I love that quote. That's super powerful. And me personally as well, like anytime I hear feedback or a success story, that's why it's all worth it. Like when I published my book, I got some review where somebody's like, I read your book. I'm moving to Australia to like start a new life and to work and travel. And I was like, everything could have stopped after that, right? That impacted somebody's life positively. They took a leap of faith. And those are the reasons, like, if you're able to build a business and build a business while impacting people positively, it's a huge win-win. And it sounds like you're doing that in almost everything you do, in your content, in your books, in your podcasts, and in all your businesses. So I'm curious, you know, is there any big risk that you're going to be taking this year to kind of continue on this upward trajectory?
Yeah, there is. I'm having a fight. That's a friggin' risk.
Yes.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So over the last 16 or 17 years in this country, in our space, in the education space, or the entrepreneurial education space. You know, I'm sort of known for doing silly, outrageous, contrarian things. And randomly, a guy who's 35 kilos heavier than me on a podcast called me out for a fight. So I bet him £50,000. Then we just signed the contracts last week and he upped it to £100,000. So on July the 1st, 2023, in front of 1,600 people, I'm going to knock him out. So that is, yeah, that's a bit different this year. I didn't wake up in 2023 on January the 1st with that in my goals, I can tell you.
Well, I'll definitely be rooting for you. And it sounds like you're going to start training here soon, or what's your goal for or plans for like cutting weight? Are you going to be doing a lot of montages with like Rocky music on, or what do you have in mind?
I don't know if you can pick them up on here, or the bruises.
Oh wow, a few cuts there, bruises on my arm.
So I don't want to give anything. Look at that, it's full of them. I don't want to give anything away in case my opponent is watching. So I've not really been training. I've been drinking, just been lazy, sitting on the sofa. I haven't trained every day. You know, I'm not going to give away any of my training. But what I will say is, we'll put on a great show. I've got a big celebrity host. We've got a couple of exciting things we're revealing. I'm going to raise, my goal is to raise £130,000, so over 150.
If you love to travel like me and you understand the power in escaping the money for time exchange trap, but you just don't know how to do it, then building an Airbnb consultancy business could be exactly what you have been looking for. Right now in the UK, there is a completely untapped opportunity through helping struggling Airbnb hosts by turning around their underperforming properties and generating you huge commission payments in the process. We are going to teach you all of the tools and all of the techniques that we've learned over the last 5 years through building our very own multiple six-figure Airbnb business, arming you with everything that you need to swoop in and save the day. Minimal startup costs, zero risk, and almost unlimited potential. Sound good? Welcome to the Airbnb Consultant. Contact us through any of the channels included in the studio notes to get the conversation started.
$50,000 for my and other charities, and just do something a bit different and fun. You know, we're not Logan Paul and KSI, but we're the next level down and we'll give it a good go.
Yeah, so how can people find out about that if they want to get involved, to donate or even tune in?
Well, I mean, look, if you just search for me, Rob Moore, you'll find all my social media, my books. Actually, tickets aren't on sale yet, but I've sold over 200 of them already.
Wow.
So, yeah, just look out for me online. But as he's a lot bigger than me, Mike, I'm not planning to cut a load of weight because I want some power behind me. So I'm just going to train really hard. And eat really hard. So I've got some power because 35 kilos to give away is quite a lot. I already know his plan. His plan is to knock me out in round one because he won't be able to, he'll be gassing by round two. So my plan is to outbox him in round one and then play with him for the next couple of rounds while he's gassing out. And then in round three, right at the end, knock him out. That's my plan.
Sounds like a great plan, Robin. Wishing you the best of luck with that. And I'll definitely be tuning in. You mentioned a few, you know, celebrities as well. You know, I'm curious, like somebody who, like yourself, is interviewing some of the most famous people in the world, who do you kind of look up to? Whose content do you consume? Whose books do you read to kind of find inspiration, learn about maybe areas that you're interested in expanding your own knowledge on? Who are those people?
Well, look, I've been studying business, entrepreneurship, and personal development for 17 years, Mike. I must have read 3,500 books, and I must have listened to thousands of podcasts. And so for me, the learning never stops. So back in the early days, when I went through more of a transformative stage of my life in terms of my attitude, you know, people like Tony Robbins, John DeMartini, Brian Tracy, you know, they were pivotal for me. And that was more personal development and mindset because I was quite negative. And I had low self-worth. Then when I got into business, I studied all the UK big entrepreneurs, maybe not so famous in the UK, but we have something in the UK called Dragon's Den, which is the Shark Tank equivalent in America. Right. So I studied all the dragons, actually got to know quite a few of them now. And so I studied all of them. And then I moved over and studied all the sharks and all the big, you know, entrepreneurs in America. And then all the big entrepreneurs with a big following, and became friends with a lot of them. I'm good friends with Grant Cardone. I'm flying out to see him in a couple of weeks' time. Then I went on a mission of studying billionaires. I think we've interviewed more than 20 on my show, just to sort of, not saying I'm necessarily going to be a billionaire or particularly want to, but I wanted to know, what does it take to have the thought process to get there? And now I'm more micro niche down into whatever project I'm working on. So at the moment, Mike, I will be watching boxing fights for the next 5 months, all day, every day. But for probably a year before, I was just reading books on money, because I'm writing a new book on money called The Money Matrix. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. If there's one person I'd probably look up to, it would probably be Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, wow.
I would say, you know, I'm probably, he would be like maybe a hero, because he's been so successful in so many disciplines. He's so grateful for his life and America embracing him as an immigrant. His book's great. He's in real estate. He became the governor. He's very likable. He's A-list. And so I suppose he's the one person I'd like to get on my podcast that maybe I haven't yet.
Wow. Well, sounds like a good goal for this year to try to get him on there. So if anybody listening knows Arnold, put him in touch with Rob, and you won't be disappointed with that. So yeah, I think that's really interesting. And the fact that you mentioned interviewing 20 billionaires, is there any, like, a couple pieces of advice or anything that you found similar between all of them that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, I actually reverse engineered about 17 traits of billionaires having done those interviews, because many of them, not only did I interview them for 90 minutes plus, I then had dinner with them or got to know them. So yeah, I've worked out about 17 common traits. So I can give you a few now, Mike. Number one is, it's like the globe is malleable to them, and it's almost like they can imagine this thing, the world, and put it in their hands and see themselves that big looking over the world. You know, if you look at Elon Musk, he just thinks, oh yeah, I'll just buy Twitter, the biggest social media platform ever. I'll just build rockets and we'll go to Mars. You know, normal people, they can't think in that scale. They can't look at the world as their playground and something that they can control. Now, of course, when they become a bit evil, they can do that in a negative way. But that's definitely one trait. The next trait is, to be a billionaire, you have to serve probably 100 million people. You can't serve, no one's a billionaire with 10 customers and 5 followers on social media. So look, some billionaires don't have massive social media followings, but they own companies that have millions or hundreds of millions of customers, or sell hundreds of millions of units. So scale. And by the way, with scale comes scaled criticism, scaled responsibility, scaled hatred from the masses. Like, think about Donald Trump. He's probably got more haters than anyone else, or, you know, but he's also very wealthy. And then there's many, but I'll give you one more, Mike. It's intense curiosity. They're, weirdly, many of the billionaires, when I interview them, they start interviewing me. I'm thinking, you're the billionaire. I should be interviewing you. But they want to learn. They are curious. They are great problem solvers. And, you know, many ordinary people, they throw their hands up in the air and act a bit childish and immature when there's a problem. Whereas billionaires tend to have a childlike curiosity to problems, or at least a belief that they can transcend all manner of problems.
Right. I mean, that's fascinating. Is there any billionaires that you can share their names about who you actually interviewed? Any famous ones?
The founder of Lululemon, the founder of Netflix, the founder of Superdry, David McCourt, Andreas Panayiotou, real estate billionaire. There's 5 off the top of the list for you. Harry, can you remember any of them? Oh, Jeff Hoffman. Who's the English guy who's doing lab-produced meat now? Yeah, there's someone who's he became a billionaire in the markets. Oh, Stephen Lansdowne of Hargreaves Lansdowne.
Wow.
Yeah. You're testing my memory here, but yeah, there's seven for you.
Wow. I mean, that's great. And was there, I'm just fascinated by how you're actually able to leverage your audience, which you have a really big following, but how do you get in touch with these types of people? You know, because looking back, you know, 4 or 5 years, it wasn't like something that you're just doing now because you have a good audience. I think this is a skill set, maybe a secret skill that you kind of have. You mentioned people like Grant Cardone, Jordan Peterson. How do you actually get in touch with these people, and how do you convince them to kind of come on your show or get in touch with you?
Yeah. So there's a few things here, and I'll list them. One is you have to be able to accept rejection and brush it off and not take it personally. Because if I've done 1,000 podcasts, Mike, I've had 10,000 rejections.
Right.
I keep my rejection letters, actually. I've had some big famous rejections. Some very well-known people who've handwritten rejection letters. So number one is you have to be able to take more rejection than you get acceptance, which then number two is your numbers game, which is if you reach out to 1,000 people, you might get 30 guests. If you reach out to 10,000 people, you might get 300 guests. The next thing is the more following you have and the more you've achieved in your life, the more doors that opens for you. So I've probably punched above my weight sometimes, and then other times I haven't managed to do that. But because, you know, I've got a bit of an established authority now, that certainly helps. The next thing is knowing how to write a very good introduction. So whenever you're outreaching, keep it short. This is important. Suggest that you may interview them and publish it across all of your media. Because I just said, you want to come on my podcast? Now I say we'll publish it on all media. And point out something different that you might ask them, or a different angle. And point out one specific thing about them that you really admire that's not known to the masses. So right. If I said, hey, Mike, it's Rob Moore. Would love to have you on my show. We've done 1,000 episodes and we publish across all channels. I really like ABC about you, but that ABC is not well known. Let me know if you're interested, and we can come to you and maybe make things happen. Just keep it generic and short, but point out a couple of things about them that you know that most people don't. For example, Mike, if you messaged me and said, Rob, I can't believe what happened to you on December the 15th, 2005. Wow, can we talk about that on my podcast? You've got me.
Right.
Because something happened on that day, which most people don't know about, which is really emotional for me. And
right.
If you did your research, you would find that out and no one else did. So if you do that to Jordan Peterson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, et cetera, you know, you cut through the noise. And importantly, big people like that, you've got to have a different angle rather than, oh, can I interview Arnold Schwarzenegger on your bicep routine? He's done that a zillion times, so...
Yeah, I do think a lot of celebrities, they want to be asked different things, right? They don't want to be asked the same questions over and over. And there's visible, you know, interviews where it's like, these questions are just, every interview, it's always the same thing. So I'm curious, what are some of these unique questions that you like to ask ask people?
Right. So we try our best to ask stuff that's a bit different. So we regularly ask people things like, would you rather have £1 million or 1 million social media followers, and why? We ask them things like, do you believe we have true freedom of speech? Who controls the world? And these questions garner very interesting responses. Certainly, who controls the world and do we have freedom of speech right now? And we used to be, I guess, the standard success podcast. I got bored of asking people how to be successful. And I like asking, even though I want to know how people are successful, I like asking questions that get them to reveal how they are successful with the, without me asking them, tell me your top five tips on making money, for example, which isn't a bad question. It's just one you've had 100 times.
Right. So to follow up and kind of follow your advice there, what is a question that you wish more people asked you?
I like talking about the money system. And I'm not bored of telling people that banks do not exist to save you money or to save your money. Banks exist to make profit from your money. And I would like to educate people that your money and savings is a risk. They don't pay you the full rate of interest. And as inflation has been way more than interest for the last 12 years, and it's even worse now, one of the worst things you can do is put your money in the bank. And therefore, then, if one of the worst things you can do is put your money in the bank, where best else can you spend, save, and invest your money? They're the kind of things I love talking about. Because I think if the world knew the motives of the banks, and instead of being a victim to the banks, they behave more like a bank, because actually the banks are smart. Like if I said to you, Mike, would you like your own currency? And would you like to have a printer behind you where you either pressed a button and pieces of paper came out and that was currency that you created, or you pressed something on a screen and millions went into your bank? Would you like to be able to do that? Of course you're going to say yes.
Love that.
Of course you would. Well, this is what the central banks do.
Right.
But we just don't, most people don't know it because the central banks don't want you to know it. So this is the stuff I like to talk about, Mike, because I think the world is hypnotized and brainwashed into believing that governments and central banks are for the people. They are the opposite. They are monopolized corporate entities veiled as a social benefit.
Yeah. It's crazy. There's one thing that I've noticed just recently. I go back to the US like once every year. I live overseas in Europe, and I'm from a suburb of St. Louis, a small town. And guess what? Some of the only things that are still in business after COVID, it's the most popular areas have kind of turned into ghost towns, but it's churches and banks are the two things that are like growing. So I go back, you know, every year and I'm like, all these businesses ran out of money, went bankrupt, but they're building more churches and banks. And it's just wild to see. And I think people don't notice it because they're not leaving as much, or maybe they're not, you know, going away for a year and coming back. But I found that was just like a fascinating thing. And I think a lot of people don't understand how their money is spent, it's actually created. And a lot of banks don't even actually hold your money. So like if you try to go into the bank to withdraw all of your money, there's about a 0% chance that they're going to be able to give it to you all, right? And so, Rob, you mentioned, you know, diversifying into some of these other assets. You know, we've talked a lot about real estate. You briefly mentioned crypto. Any other, you know, where are you putting your money outside of, you know, real estate in your business?
I think if you have a business or businesses, whether it's software like you like to do, recurring income models are great, Mike, or a membership site like I have, or a training type company, an information type business, that's a great way to generate income. So even though it's not an investment asset, it's an income generating asset. So you certainly want an income generating asset in the form of a business. In terms of assets, I think you want a mix of physical, local real estate, because you know it the best, you can control it the best, you can manage it the best. I think you definitely want to be in the S&P 500 or the FTSE 100. You know, one major bank could go down with all your money in it, but the top 100 companies or 500 companies in the country or the world are not going to go down. They're only going to grow and they're averaged out. So you should be maxing your tax-free allowances and putting your money into, you know, a diversified stock market portfolio, ideally yourself, not through a fund manager who's going to cream off most of your profits. Then I think you should have physical assets as well, like gold. So Krugerrands and Britannia coins from the UK Royal Mint are good. Gold bullion bars. The good thing about them is you can store them securely, safely, and discreetly. I like watches. So I buy Patek Philippe's, Rolexes, and Audemars Piguet, and a few other boutique watch brands that do well and go up. I like wearing them. It's really the only jewelry I wear, but they have really appreciated over the last few years. I think some Bitcoin is good. Most crypto is actually not decentralized. So you're essentially just investing into someone else's business, but you think it's decentralized. So I'd be wary of most crypto, but Bitcoin, I think, is probably fairly safe and solid. One thing that I think the government and the central banks won't want you to know, which is why I'm telling you, is when money is worthless, things are worth more. And then when money is worth more, things are worth less. So at the moment, money is worthless. It's going down at 10% a year. They can print and reduce that value even further. It's not real. It's not backed by anything. Like you said, Mike, the fractional reserve banking system means the banks only have to keep 10% of your deposits and 90% they can lend and invest out. So we're in this debt spiral Ponzi scheme in the monetary system. So money is worthless. Therefore, things are worth more. So you might want to start investing in things. So I have classic cars. I have a Ferrari Testarossa. I have a 1989 Porsche 911 Turbo. I'm not saying go and invest in those. They have high running costs and insurance costs. But start looking into art, watches. Some ladies' handbags have gone mad. And actual physical tradable things. You know, if you think about if there was an apocalypse, gold's going to be tradable. Cigarettes are going to be tradable. Useful, practical things are going to be tradable. Metals are going to be tradable. And money's going to be worthless. So that's just something to think about in this changing world.
Yeah, I think it's always good to have 6 to 12 months and some liquid asset, maybe some physical assets as well. If you do have to sell a piece of art, a watch, something like that, gold, anything that can be, you know, maybe some utility there. But I do think there's probably different investment advice for the people. Let's say they're earning from $50,000 to $100,000 a year. I think those people need to invest in probably one of your, you know, 17 books because they're going to get the biggest ROI there. I think investing in coaching, in online mentorship, in networking, those types of things are going to give them the biggest ROI to kind of get to that next level. Is that something that you would agree with, Rob, or what are your kind of thoughts on, like, you know, the average world is not making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars, but what would you recommend kind of that average person making $70,000 a year? What should they invest in?
I fully agree with you, Mike. I think that actually the best asset that you can invest in is yourself. You are your best investment. Invest in yourself wisely. You pay yourself the best return. Warren Buffett says his single best investment was learning to do public speaking at the Dale Carnegie School, I think it was. It might have been Toastmasters, but anyway, he learned to public speak. And he said that that was one of his best, if not his best, investments. So Brian Tracy says you should invest minimum 10% of your earnings or the value of your car into. So I have a Lamborghini Aventador, which is about $350,000. So I've got a lot of courses I've got to buy. Now, in my book, Money, I recommend people do something that most people don't know to do, and that is to become your own IFA. So in England, we have what's called IFAs. You'll have the similar in America. Independent financial advisor, who's not independent and they don't really have much money. So therefore their advice is not really that good. So most people think, oh, I don't know how to manage and invest my own money. I'll go to an independent financial advisor. No, you should be your own independent financial advisor. You wouldn't outsource the raising of your kids to someone else. You can't outsource your own physical exercise and health and well-being. Your own money and how you manage it should be done by you, not by a biased, non-independent, independent financial advisor. So learn how to make, manage, multiply, master, and invest your own money.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's funny, you know, I went to university, I studied finance and real estate, and, you know, they don't really teach you how to make money with it. They kind of teach you how to get a job. They teach you some macroeconomic indicators, and they don't really put you on the path to start a business, to necessarily invest in a strategy that's going to give you early retirement. these financial advisors you recommend, they're setting you up for retirement in your 70s. But if you want to do it earlier, you're going to have to do something different, right? You're going to have to do something a little bit more riskier, like you mentioned earlier, in one of your favorite quotes. So I do think if you're following that path and expecting different results, you're not going to achieve that. You got to find people who are following a different path. Try to reverse engineer what they're doing. And again, when I was getting started, books, courses, finding people that are two or three steps ahead of you and just trying to find some value that you can bring into their life is going to be the fastest way for growth. Now, Rob, did you have any sort of mentors? It sounds like your dad maybe was a mentor, or some family members, anybody in your life that kind of outside of family that was a mentorship or helped you kind of learn about what you know now?
For 27 years, no one really. My dad, when I was young, yes, but he wouldn't. He was just being a dad. He wouldn't have known he was being a mentor. But from about the age of 30, once I started to see the benefit of standing on the shoulders of giants and leveraging the traits of the greats, I started to invest in mastermind and mentoring programs. So yeah, I've had mentoring from one of the dragons on Dragon's Den in the UK. His name's James Kahn. And I would certainly regard a lot of the work of Dr. John DeMartini as mentorship to me. And I had mentoring sessions with a billionaire real estate investor in the UK when I was in my early 30s. And to be honest, I'm probably ready for the next level. I now invest more into mastermind programs. So the good and bad thing about having a mentor is it's one person.
Right.
They can either answer the question or they can't. Whereas if you're in a mastermind group with peers and some mentors of 12 or 15 people, you've got a lot more experience there. So I've actually just been invited into an 8-figure mastermind in America. You have to be doing more than 10 million a year. Thankfully, the pound is still worth more than the dollar. So that gives me a bit more punching up. And I'm in a syndicate mastermind in the UK, where maybe most of the top event promoters in the entrepreneurial space are in it. So I like masterminds now because you can leverage 12 or 15 minds rather than just one.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I essentially got started as well with a lot of my businesses. If you don't have somebody or you don't have a community, start creating it yourself. I created multiple masterminds and, outside of adding business value, I was essentially adding value by putting these groups of people in the same room, having a structure, picking a time, kind of picking a location, and then just having a structure on how we're going to go each week or each 2 weeks, holding each other accountable. And I think no matter what level you're at, try to find people with, similar sort of goals, or at least moving towards, wanting to start their own business, wanting to have self-improvement. If you find those people and put them in the same room and find some accountability between each other, you're going to grow at a 10x pace than if you're trying to do it by yourself. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs do that where they're like, I have to do everything on my own. Most entrepreneurs struggle with their first hire or with joining a mastermind or a networking group. But that's where I've seen some of the biggest growth and biggest ROIs. So I'm curious, Rob, you do so much in the content space. How do you go about, what is your content strategy? How are you able to produce so much content and so high quality content over a long period of time?
I have a very active mind. I can't sit still. I don't rest very easily. And so in some regards, that helps with content because in a way, content is the therapy for that. So if anyone is watching or listening and thinks they've got ADHD or can't sit still or can't switch off, hone that energy into content and you'll do really well. The next thing is I'm very strict with my routines, Mike. So I wrote a book called Routine Equals Results. And I built an individual routine based on my own circadian rhythm, my own workflow, my own peaks and troughs of energy and productivity within the day. And then I overlaid that with some testing on social media. And so worked out the best times for me to create content for my energy and the algorithmic reach, which would be 8:30 a.m. and 8 p.m. most days, certainly on Facebook. And then what I've been trying to do in recent years, Mike, is take one piece of content and create multiple from them. So, for example, this piece of content will probably go on your audio show, your video show. It will go on my audio and video show. We'll slice and dice up some TikToks and reels and things like that. And we might get 20 or 25 pieces of content out of this. So, you know, content repurposing and content leverage helps you just leverage your time a bit more. The thing with ideation is everyone's actually really creative and can come up with loads of ideas. People just think that they're not. And you'll have a lot of ideas in a day, but you just won't know how to capture them. So just a little tip here is just always have a notepad or your note app on your phone and just make a habit of whenever the idea flies into your mind like a butterfly, stop whatever you're doing, get your phone or your notepad out and just make a note of it and store it. So, Mike, if I'd have had an idea, for example, I've had an idea that I should have Kevin O'Leary on the show. Kevin O'Leary is a massive watch guy. He's a big entrepreneur. I'm a watch guy. And, you know, he knows a lot of the rare watches. I know a lot of the rare watches. And so immediately when we're done, I will write to my, you know, my agent, let's go to America and do something with Kevin O'Leary. But you have to capture it in the moment when the idea comes. So just always have your, sometimes you get an idea in the shower or at 3 a.m. right, or driving or whatever. But most people, they wait and they miss the idea. If you do that and you keep a folder, you'll have the opposite problem. You won't have not enough ideas. You'll have too many ideas.
Yeah, I have that happen all the time. I'm in the shower and, you know, basically I think of something and I do it. I will jump out of the shower to grab my phone and just so I write it down and so it happens. And that's one of those things. I think a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of business people, they're so focused on, you know, they're in front of their laptop, they're working, you know, they're going from point A to point B, they're thinking about the next step. You need to find things like taking a shower. You know, like for me, it's I love to swim. There's no devices. There's nothing, no electronics. I'm just swimming for, you know, 30 minutes straight. And I get some of like the clear mindset and I come up with some of those best ideas. And I think a lot of the big, really impactful ideas in your life are not going to come from in front of a camera or in front of a laptop. They're going to come from when you're going on a walk with your dog or you're just sitting around in a park. And that's why I think meditation and stuff is so crucial. So I'm curious, you know, you mentioned your routine there earlier. Can you give us a quick glimpse into what your routine looks like every day?
I get up around 5:30 to 6 a.m. I get the same type of coffee at 6 a.m. From 6 to 8 a.m., I either write or create content or manage my workflow. I'll have a very specific smoothie with various supplements for hopefully a very healthy living at about 8 p.m. At 8:30 a.m., I'll do a Facebook Live. 8:45 to about 9:30 a.m., I'll continue to do some high priority tasks. 9:30 a.m., I'll go for a walk. I'll go for a few miles and I'll pick up my next coffee. I'll come back and I'll do key result area income generating task work till about midday. I'll sometimes train in the morning or I'll sometimes train in the afternoon. I always have ice bath or cold shower every day. I do meetings from about midday to 3, but I ideally don't stack it full. So ideally it'll be 2 of those 3 hours. Interviews I usually do at 3 p.m. UK time, like we are here, because 5 p.m. I'm knackered. 12 a.m. I'm still a bit too hyped on the coffee. It's quite a good mix. I build Lego as a way to relax and therapy for myself and probably stop me going insane and creating chaos around the world, much to the frustration of my wife with all these massive Star Wars sets all over the house. And I work from home a lot of that time, so I make sure that I always make the kids a priority, try and walk as much as I can. When I'm in the car, I try and listen to audiobooks and podcasts to leverage the time. Sometimes when I train as well. And then Harry and I do a lot of road trips. So Harry, who's behind the cameras there, he's head producer. We do these boys on tour road trips where I'm going to meet Patrick Bet-David, Grant Cardone, Elena Cardone in America in a couple of weeks. We did two or three guests in a day, and Harry drives my Porsche, and we just go on the road and plot how to take over the world and chat shit and we always play Would You Rather, and we always find out each other's price. Like, for 10 million, would you? Would you, for 100 million, do this? And that's my life.
That's fascinating, Rob. Yeah, it sounds like a really interesting routine, really, you know, strict. And I think a lot of people at your level, they need to have a routine. Almost every millionaire, billionaire, they have different pieces, different times they wake up. But there's a lot of key elements. They're very structured and they're very consistent, right? And you mentioned you drink a lot of coffee, right? I was talking with some of my friends yesterday about how the UK, there's a lot of trace to the UK becoming so successful because they drink a lot of tea and they're very caffeinated and just wanting to become productive people. So I'm curious if you think there's any truth to that.
I can't speak for anyone else, but I can definitely say for caffeine in the right dosage is probably 60% of the reason why I've done things fast or well or at scale, because my work ethic and focus and speed on the right dose of caffeine is definitely another level for me. And without it, you would not want to be anywhere near me without caffeine.
Right. Yeah. I took a month off of caffeine and it was like my least productive month. I was very tired. And looking back, I was like, this was just a terrible idea. If, you know, I would have been a month ahead if I hadn't done this. So I do think it's all about the right, you know, sort of amount for your body. Some people metabolize it a lot faster. So I guess, Rob, I appreciate all your time here. Just a couple more questions to wrap things up. But, you know, what is one question that you wish I would have asked you today? You know, I'm always wanting to get better at my interviewing, and you know, you're somebody that does a lot of interviews. So
I never wish anything were different. Things are as they're supposed to be. I guess if I were to give you feedback, it might be one or two more left field questions, quirky questions, or more personal questions. Or, because I interviewed Andrew Tate just before he went to prison and I got to know him quite well. Detained, not in prison, but really it's the same thing.
Right.
And he said, I said, what? He asked for my feedback. I gave it to him. And I said to him, if there was one thing I could have done different on this interview, what would it be? And he said, more arguments. So maybe in the future, you and I should discuss things we disagree with, because we clearly believe a lot of the same things and have a lot in common, which is great. And that's how we should build a relationship. But I think people like a good ding-dong debate. So maybe that would be for next time.
Yeah, I would love that. I definitely have been starting some debates with the whole real estate. You know, my theory is investing in online businesses that are cash flowing from day one is going to be a better investment than investing in real estate. But I think that's an argument for another day. But I guess if you mind sharing a little bit about your personal life, you mentioned that as a question. What do you, when the cameras are off, when the routine finishes, what are two or three things that you just love doing, you know, outside of work? You mentioned Legos. Is there any other things that you enjoy doing?
Yeah, I'm 43 and I build Lego. I shouldn't really admit that in public, should I? They are complicated ones, like 7,000 pieces. You know, they're not Duplo. Just want to make that clear. I love watches. I love cars. I've got a collection of both. I love Alexander McQueen. I always wear it. I love meeting interesting people. I love talking about business and finance and money. I'm obviously now having a fight, so I'm very interested in training and fighting. But really, my work is my life, and my life is my work, and my passion is my profession, and I'm very lucky.
Right. Well, it's great to hear. I think, you know, aligning those things, having a passion that you can make money from is going to be the best route forward. Now, I guess, you know, as far as time, do you have a few more minutes, or do you want to wrap up here with anything?
I can do 3 minutes, because we've got a group training session. So I can do three.
Maybe we should try to do a hot take, like you mentioned, something more controversial. So maybe let's say, like, what's your most controversial opinion on the world?
You want to get me cancelled, Mike?
I do not.
I won't give my most controversial opinion.
Okay.
All right, then I'll tell you a couple of things. Number one is too many people's opinions mean virtually nothing, and they think their opinions are far more important than they actually are. So know that your opinion is only an opinion. And if it's useful and valuable to a lot of people, great. And if it's just an opinion that you're blurting out on social media, know that it's not really that important. So I think sometimes we have an over aggrandized version of our own opinion. That's one opinion of mine that a lot of people might not like to hear. The next thing, like the English-American divide, this is a big one. A lot of the Americans say that you should rent your own home. I personally think that's utter nonsense. I know people who reckon they're billionaires. I know they're not, but they reckon they are. And they reckon that you should rent your own home and not buy it. And to me, it just doesn't make any sense. Because if you're a billionaire, you can own 10 homes around the world, number one. Maybe the rules are different, but in the UK, you get what's called PPR relief, which basically means when you buy your home, you do it up, you make money, you sell it to buy another home. There's no tax on the capital gain. So you can buy a home, do it, you can buy it cheap, do it up, make money, get a bigger one and a bigger one and a bigger one and trade up from a two bed to a mansion with no tax. Yeah. So why would you not do that? The next thing is rent is dead money. And now people say, oh, yeah, but travel. Well, if you want to travel, rent your house out and get income from the rent to pay for your travel. There's a load of other reasons, like capital growth in the UK is really good. They double every 10 to 15 years. Mortgage interest has been really cheap, basically free money for the last 12 years. So there's loads of reasons why this advice of rent your own home, don't buy it is nonsense. And I'll have a debate with any American on this. And I will beat them all hands down.
Yeah, I would love to hear that debate. For me, I guess my mindset is you want to put money where it's going to get the give you the biggest ROI. And for a lot of people, they can leverage a mortgage to rent a rental home or to buy a rental home and start cash flowing. And for a lot of people, that's the best option. But it really depends on what situation you're in. I think probably a big differentiator between the US and the UK is when you sell this property, there's a big tax in the US, somewhere to 30 to 40%, depending on what, if it's a rental property or a single individual home, it's going to vary per state, per city. But it seems like you guys got a great system in the UK.
Is there big tax even on your own personal dwelling, not on rental, but on your own personal home?
I mean, there's property tax, right? So each year you have to pay property tax on your own personal asset, which is crazy.
Yeah, we don't have that in the UK, but you know, any money you spend on the house on a rental is money you're giving to someone else,
right?
You can't. Here's another thing, like Mike, let me ask you this. Do you think environment plays a part in success?
100%.
Yeah. So imagine having a shitty rental that you're living in, or a rental that's just not your home. Even if it's a nice expensive rental, it doesn't feel like home. Right. I imagine it's not the best environment to raise a family and take over the world. Whereas if I have got a pad, that's what we call it in the UK. Like I've got boys' toys and loads of rooms and an outdoor gym and big garage extension with all my cars and a big glass wall. And I feel like a king in my own home, even if I'm not anywhere else. And that's a conducive place to taking over the world. Not some crappy rental with a shitty fireplace and red carpet.
Right.
So I think that no one really talks about that, the environment that you create in a home you own. And you're not going to do that in a rental because it's dead money.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think each person's situation is going to be different. For you, it definitely makes sense. And there's peace of mind of just owning your own place, making it your own home. But it really depends on people's financial situations. I do think a lot of times people in the US, they'll over leverage themselves to buy a place that's maybe a little bit outside of their budget. And maybe they got approved for a loan they shouldn't have gotten approved for. In those situations, I think, you know, that's what essentially caused the 2008 economic crisis. But I think that's each person is going to have a different financial situation. So it's very hard to give that black or white advice. But appreciate your insight there, Rob. You know, you've obviously had a lot of success with real estate and you're helping others. So anything else you want to add? You know, how can people get in touch? Where should you follow where do you kind of send people to kind of get in touch with you?
Well, if you just Google my name, Rob Moore, you should find me on all platforms. As we're on a podcast here, the Disruptors podcast, if you like listening to podcasts, if you want to dive into my books, probably the one you want to start with is Money. And you can find me on all socials, Rob Moore Progressive. You'll find me on all socials.
Awesome, Rob. Well, if you're listening in, guys, make sure you subscribe to Rob, follow him on all of his social medias. And while you're at it, do the same for me. You can Google Mike Swagunski. I'm on active on LinkedIn, Instagram, all the social media. But Google is probably the easiest way to get in touch with me. So, Rob, I'm going to be digging through some of your books. And I hope people listening in do that, because as we figured out, probably the most people listening in right now, that's going to be the best investment for you. Audiobooks, physical books, finding some knowledge, and you know, taking yourself to the next level there. So thank you, Rob. Thank you for your time. It was really lovely chatting with you.
Thanks, Mike. Just before you end, how do you spell your surname for my listeners? That, because I know it's not the easiest one.
Oh, yeah. So it's Swigunski, Swigunski. So yeah, if you put that in the Google, or if you go to MikeSwagunski.com, you can kind of find everything.
Thanks, Mike. It's been a pleasure.